Hey, welcome to another week of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. I'm Lauren Fox.
And I'm Andrew Hansen.
And we're back here in the studio.
Yes,
another
we are.
Friday.
It is.
Let's see. I mean, it feels like a lot has happened, even though really nothing has happened. I don't know. I mean,
I think a lot has happened.
In the scheme of things, nothing really happened. Let's see. I don't even know. Where should we even start? Should we start with the debut of the most heralded rookie since LeBron James?
Zion!
Yeah, so...
Wow!
That was fun. Look at... That was loud. I see, like, I'm looking at the sound wave, and all of a sudden, Hansen goes straight into the red. He was so excited.
Zion deserves that sound wave.
Yeah. He didn't... You know, it's really funny how things go with our 24-hour news cycle. You have to have a take news cycle. Like, you and I would never last on a big sports station because we're not edgy enough. Like, I'm not talking about Zion Williamson will never play a game in the NBA and this is why, and he's going to be an abject failure. I mean, that's like, you know, and the thing about like regular sports talk radio is nobody ever calls them on it after the fact. Oh yeah, dude, remember when you said that Zion was going to be horrible? How about now? What do you think now?
There is one place on Twitter for things like that. It's a Twitter handle called Freezing Cold Takes. It is hilarious. All he does is retweet predictions and strong comments that are completely off base.
It's just nonsense. It's like, you know, I guess it's kind of how everything goes anyway, where I guarantee you, whether it's any of the news stations or any of the sports stations, somebody walks in and says, well, this is what my take is. So you go and have the opposite take. And I mean, I remember, God, we did this stuff in college. I wrote a sports column, shocking, in a paper that was distributed at around USC and UCLA. And
did it go to both schools?
Yes, it did.
Whoa, what was it called?
It was called 28th Street Magazine.
Okay.
I mean, it was actually like a nice, well put together thing. But I mean, it would like, I would compare it now to like the Hippo in terms of what it looks like and the overall, you know, quality of journalism, all that sort of stuff. But I grabbed one of my best friends and I said, hey, we want to write a pro and con column. And somebody said, oh, yeah, write the column on whether Joe Montana would be any good if Jerry Rice wasn't with him.
Okay.
And my buddy got...
The precursor to the Belichick-Brady article.
Right. I mean, that's really it. My buddy got the Joe Montana would have been great regardless side, and I'm sitting there trying to justify the fact that Joe Montana was not very good, which I didn't agree with. So, you know,
Were you uncomfortable with that?
It was just bad. You know, it's kind of
basically
like,
scarred you to this day.
It's writing an... Yeah, obviously. I don't forget anything. It's writing an article that you completely disagree with. Well, these guys on radio get up and blather on about things that they don't agree with. And, you know, you heard a lot of talking about Zion Williamson as this guy is going to fail, I think simply because it generates clicks. And people, no, that's never going to happen. And of course, he did not fail.
No, he did not. He succeeded in every way. It was a beautiful thing. Got me up off the couch.
Really?
I mean, it was inspiring.
And that's a comfortable couch.
I know.
I mean, that's the kind of couch if I've had a couple adult beverages, like it really is. It's like the beach chair in Dazed and Confused.
I mean, that's what it's designed for. Full comfort for your viewing. But Zion is a once-in-a-generation player and personality. I just love everything about him. And the exciting thing about the game was it was such a contrast in performance and mood. The first three quarters, it was pretty subdued, where he only played 4 minutes at a time and didn't take that many shots, wasn't as aggressive early, was trying to get his teammates involved. But there was this one play, I think it was in the third quarter, where he went up for a rebound, and it was probably the best rebound I've seen all day, because he went over a much bigger spur to get it. And
yeah,
then
and
he
it,
starts
it,
the fast
and it was
break.
Not an over the back.
No.
No.
He just jumped over him, started the fast break, nice cross pass assist, and then when he came out in the fourth quarter, that's when things got crazy, because he took his first three-pointer, made it, comes down, hits another one. Before you know it, in about a three-minute span, he scored 17 points, completely energized the building, got the Pelicans back into the game. The fans are chanting MVP, And it's his first game ever at the NBA level. It was phenomenal.
Yeah, he goes 4 for 4 from three-point land. And then because he's done so well in one game, what do we now have to talk about? His weight.
Oh, well, I mean, we continue to talk. Those out there continue to talk about it. It's not a new topic. I mean, they were talking about it when he was in college. They were talking about it during the preseason. And they're going to continue to talk about it.
It's not like he's Tractor Trailer or Charles Barkley.
Right. I mean, he's built. He's a bull, and it's. I mean, he's carried himself that way pretty well so far, I'd say.
Right. Oh, the thing that I was most impressed. Obviously, it's hard to dismiss 17 points in whatever 3 or 4 minutes, and 4 for 4 from three. He plays at an intellectual level that you wouldn't expect from a guy at NBA game number one.
He's 19,
not scared, not intimidated. They were kind of couching it as, oh yeah, he plays with finesse. No, he's just a smart player, and he's not backing down from anything. And if the NBA doesn't screw this up, you have your next one name guy.
Absolutely.
And you have Ja Morant, who, I mean, would be a one name guy if Ja Morant didn't just flow off the tongue like that.
That's true.
You know,
that's
true. I don't know. It was great to see it. What I want more than anything for the NBA, because they have done such a good job, and you and I have talked about this before. They've really done a great job of letting the players play, but second of all, letting the players actually have personalities on social media, and in real life, and have feuds between each other and have rivalries. And you know, these guys are buddies because this is a day and age of player movement and AAU where they knew each other way back. I mean, they have a level of knowledge of each other far above what they would have 20, 25 years ago. And they've done a really good job of just letting the players be who they are. And you have another opportunity to let a guy who's a very gifted, intelligent player be who he is. Let him do it. I mean, he is your next generation.
And the great thing about Zion is he has that personality that's just effervescent. I mean, it's so appealing.
Yeah.
And you listen to his interviews, they're very natural, and you know, he's humble, he's not scripted, and you know, then in terms of his game, I like that word you used with finesse, because he's also one of the most powerful players that probably we'll ever see. And I don't have any doubts about his greatness. I people talk about, oh, he's not going to be a great shooter. We heard that in college. And I don't agree with that. I don't think he's going to go out and shoot 48% from three-point land for the season. But, I mean, look at the way he's flowing with that shot. You can't go 4 for 4 from three-point land and, you know, not have a smooth stroke. I mean, I guess you can, but he does. It's smooth. It's not perfect. His shot's a little bit flat, but he obviously rises to the occasion, and it was just phenomenal.
Well, you look at the guys, the big men in the league. Now, I was watching the Lakers briefly last night, and Anthony Davis shot a three, and you know, it clangs loudly off the back iron and looked gross. And you look at things like that. There are big guys who will go out there and shoot well, but there's always a caveat for a big guy.
Right.
And he could be one who shoots well just in general. And if you can do that and pull your man away from the basket, New Orleans is such an underrated place. Like you and I were talking about it. I wouldn't mind going for a road trip to go watch Zion play down in
that'd be fun.
The Crescent City.
That would be fun. And the rest of the team is going to be a lot of fun to watch in the coming years. I mean, he's got a nice chemistry with Lonzo Ball. And we know that for all that we've said about the Ball family, Lonzo is a terrific passer. And they are going to have some highlight reel plays for years to come if they stay together. And then you've got Jrue Holiday, who is one of the best two-way players in the NBA. Brandon Ingram has come out, and he's having a breakout all-star season. So that core right there, if they keep them together, they're going to be an exciting, successful team you know, for years to come.
Yeah, it will certainly be interesting. So that was kind of the top story as far as sports goes. As far as basketball goes, we also had a college game that where the ending sort of dwarfed the rest of the game, as it were. And in that case, it was your beloved Jayhawks. I don't watch them nearly as religiously as you do. Were you watching it live?
I was not. We were on vacation, actually, for Sarah's birthday, but I started getting texts from a couple close friends who know about my passion for the Jayhawks. You know, have you seen this? Do you know what's going on? So I pull up Twitter, and it's only been about 3 or 4 minutes, and you've already got a video of the fight on Twitter, and it was not a pleasant scene. You know, that's not what we like to tune in to see at Fog Allen.
Yeah, it was a little bit rough for starters. And what happened, in case you missed it, was KU was basically dribbling out the clock right around half court. Game was ending. I think they were up by 22 points, something like that. Literally, there were 2 seconds left in the game. And one of the K-State players steals the ball, which not really necessary there. Like, they're waving the white flag, just let them wave it. And he steals the ball and goes up for a dunk or a layup. I'm not entirely sure which. And Silvio D'Souza of Kansas just cleans him out. And then it really turned into...
Blocks
the shot.
Doesn't foul him, just blocks it.
Yeah, well, they call the players back onto the court after that
for the technical.
For the technical, but blocks the shot. And then that turns into a complete Donnybrook down on the court, I guess, would be to throw out an old sports term. But that's what it turned into, was that. And you had... guys not in uniform involved. I'm not entirely certain who it was. You had band members being thrown to the ground. You had Silvio D'Souza with a chair over his head until he finally got religion and realized that if you smash somebody with a chair, you'll probably not play again ever.
Right.
So any hope of future income might be tied to whether he chooses to impale somebody with a piece of furniture. But it got really messy down there really fast. They've since handed out some suspensions, though.
Yeah, he got 12 games, so he's going to miss the rest of the regular season, the Big 12 schedule.
Who's the governing body who gave him 12?
Well, interesting here, it was the Big 12.
Okay.
And what I'm gathering from the article is because it was a Big 12 conference game, the Big 12 was in charge of the discipline.
Okay.
As opposed to the greater NCAA body.
Well, the NCAA usually handles infractions like recruiting issues and improper benefits to players and things like that. I can't remember a situation ever where the NCAA has had to step in because of an on-field issue. And for some reason, and I'm old and my brain plays tricks on me. I seem to remember back when that schools were levying penalties on players, but that is probably incorrect.
Well, in this case, Kansas suspended Souza indefinitely while they're waiting for the pending Big 12 ruling. Yeah. And so once that ruling came out, then that's what they're going to go with.
Yeah. So that was an ugly one. I guess as we're talking about college basketball, it's an interesting season so far where they're it's going to be another one of those NCAA tournaments where all my one seeds are out by the end of the second weekend. Like nothing is going to go according to chalk this year.
Yeah, I was thinking about that where I heard about the parity and, 30 different teams have a chance to win it. And I'm thinking, man, it's going to be a lot tougher to fill out a bracket this year.
I don't think if you were to look at my numbers on brackets for the last few years, you would think it was already very difficult to fill out a bracket. So, I don't know. That will be an interesting one. Let's see. We got a Super Bowl matchup set. It is, and I'm not a Chiefs fan. I know you've spent a great amount of time in Kansas. Chiefs fan? No.
No. Wouldn't call myself a Chiefs fan.
No, I wouldn't either. And somebody came up to me the other day and, congrats on the Chiefs. And I'm like, okay.
Thanks.
I really have nothing to say. Like, I think the only, we may own two things that have a Chiefs insignia on them in our house. And one is like a travel coffee mug that my wife got free somewhere. And the other one is a crock pot, which may or may not actually still exist. I may have thrown it up.
Is that for the tailgating?
Yeah, but it's kind of a small crock pot, so it's really useless for just about anything.
Family tailgating only.
Yeah, like if you were going to make a really small thing a queso, it would work for a little bit. But, you know, I guess on the topic of the Chiefs, it's funny where the conversations go to after a team gets there. And in the case of the Chiefs, what people are talking about is Andy Reid's chance to be a Hall of Fame coach or cement his legacy. But if you look at him, first of all, okay, he went to the Eagles, or went to the Eagles, went to the Super Bowl with the Eagles back in the day when McNabb was his quarterback. He's had a very good career as a coach. I don't know that he's been an NFL coach for, I'm guessing, 20-something years. Is that right? It seems like he's been there for 1,000 years.
At least.
Okay, so I don't know if winning one Super Bowl, it's nice, and he would wear that ring with pride, as would all the players. You know, I don't know that that's what he needs. I think he's already got a legacy, not to mention he's got his coaching tree of players around the league who have started with him and have kind of worked their way up.
Yeah, I think he's a Hall of Famer already. And I've just pulled up the wins list for coaches. He's seventh all time already.
Okay, that's
at
stunning.
207. And to your point, he's coached for 21 years. And
that's a good guess.
Yeah, I think he's a Hall of Famer already because of the longevity, the success, the fact that he's already gotten to the Super Bowl now twice. So, it would be fun for him. It seems like he gets a lot of support from his coaching colleagues. But this could be an interesting race because, as I've mentioned before here, I think Belichick is going for the all-time record, and he is 55 behind Don Shula. So give him 5 more years, he's going to pass Don Shula. And then how long will Andy Reid go? Because, you know, he's only 67 behind Bill Belichick. So if he coaches 6 or 7 years longer than Belichick, maybe he gets there too.
If I were either of them, I don't know how much longer I would be doing it. You know, in the case of Belichick, if he's still got Tom Brady as quarterback, he's the only one who's going to be going for the MVP and the AARP at the same time. So there's that. That's 18 minutes into the show, Harry, just in case you need to know. But, you know, I don't know that Andy Reid's going to stick around that long. He would be one that I could see, all right, he got it and he goes a couple more years, and that's sort of kind of the end, and he's passing it on to somebody else. He's been a great one to go back to his coaching tree. He, as of 2018, had 10 coaches that had coached under him that were now head coaches or that had been head coaches. 7 had led teams to the playoffs. 4, Harbaugh, Doug Peterson, Ron Rivera, Brad Childress, who was with Minnesota. This is before Sean McDermott had taken the Bills to where they are. I mean, it's really impressive when you look at the list of people who he has basically brought up through the ranks.
Yeah, absolutely. And to get back to the projection about when they might stop, Andy Reid is 61, Belichick is 67. So he would basically have to coach as long as Belichick.
Yes.
To try and match him.
I would be so in the Caribbean, like at my beach bar, doing not a whole lot of anything.
Yeah, I think if I had to predict, I'd say there's a better chance that Belichick coaches until he's 73 than Andy Reid.
Yes, I would bet it. I would say there's a strong chance that Belichick will still be coaching when Andy Reid retires.
Ooh, I don't know. That'll be close. You know, the thing that
that's a solid prop bet.
Might keep Andy Reid young is Patrick Mahomes.
Yes. Well, I mean, I'm glad you brought that up because I didn't want to lose that one. The Mahomes is, he's a privilege to watch. And he was...
How about that run?
Yeah,
for
I was
going to
say that I shouted downstairs when that happened. And
what did you shout?
Holy blank. In front of my kids. Sorry. And my wife was upstairs and she goes, what happened? And I said, it's so difficult to describe. For those who didn't see it, he took off down the left side, looked like he was going to go out of bounds, stayed in bounds. And then when he got to about the 5-yard line, realized that he was close to pay dirt and got to about the 2 before he was met by a pair of defenders for Tennessee, at which point he turned into a running back and basically dragged them both into the end zone with him in a barrel roll. It was, one of the best plays I've seen an NFL player make. From the, he's finding a way to stay in bounds. He really is doing it with his feet, and he doesn't get enough credit for as good of a runner as he is. But that arm, like, and the fact that he can throw it from 8,000 arm angles.
And he does.
I don't know if, I think we mentioned it a few weeks ago, and they were talking about Tim Tebow and not having a good arm angle, all that sort of stuff. It doesn't matter what your arm angle is if your arm is strong and you can get the ball where it needs to go.
I mean, he's just so fun to watch. That run, when it happened, I said, that might be one of the best five rushes a quarterback has ever had in the NFL, given everything that went into it, how it happened, and then the context of it. But then you talk about the way that he passes, the different arm angles. You know, I think his baseball background certainly helps. And I think it was Chris Collinsworth who pointed out that when he's looking down the field, he's looking at defenders more than most quarterbacks. He's not just looking at his receiver and tracking his route and trying to figure out, you know, when and where should I throw it to hit my receiver. He's looking at the defender and thinking, how can I slip this in past the defender? Do I have enough room to beat this defender? What arm angle do I need to get it past the lineman?
Right.
It's next level. Right. Where he's looking at the defenders.
Anybody who's ever played pickup football, you know, where you 3-on-3, 4-on-4, whatever, you realize pretty quickly that not everything you're throwing is straight up over the top. And there are some times that, you know, you're just playing flag or whatever, and you're forced out and you roll out and you're, all right, I just need to get rid of the football, whatever the angle is. And the NFL and college have really been hesitant to embrace what any of us who ever played pickup sandlot football have known for a really long time, that the goal is to complete the pass. The goal is not to look like a textbook quarterback when you complete the pass. The goal is to complete it. You know, and you know, even down to the dumb things of playing flag football, where the rule was two completions is a first down. Well, guess what? It doesn't matter if I throw this beautiful thing. A shovel pass works just the same. It's a completion.
Yeah, and what you're doing for our listeners is you're throwing the ball from your chest, you know, with your elbow out.
It's a flip. But that's what Mahomes did. It was the little jet sweep to Tyreek Hill. Mahomes is in the shotgun, gets the snap. Hill comes in front of him, flips it in front of him. Tyreek Hill runs right to the left into the end zone, gets a touchdown out of it. You look at it, and my brain goes, well, that was a run. And you look at the stat, and it says, T. Hill, 10-yard touchdown reception. Wait a second. It counts.
These days, it's a pass. And the thing that he has is he's got the confidence and the creativity to go next level and do all these different things. It gives him an edge.
And nobody has said to him, dude, you can't do that. You can't throw the ball like that. It's like, you'd be foolish too. He threw one in that game that when he threw it, he was probably at the 35 or 40 yard line. When he threw it, I said, oh, he's just getting rid of it out of the end zone. Like his pocket had broken down. The coverage was good. And so all he was doing at that point was, I thought, I'm just going to launch it deep, you know, into the first row of seats behind the end zone, so I can live to fight another day. Travis Kelce caught it. I don't know if you saw that play.
Yeah, yeah.
Kelce caught it and was out of bounds by about a foot.
Right.
Like, it was
so close.
Right where it was supposed to be. And
where only Kelce could catch it.
And
on the boundary.
And the rest of us are, I'm sitting there, you know, my wife gets excited because the quarterback's dropping back and he's throwing a deep ball, and she knows football pretty well, but he's throwing a deep ball. Like, that's like a hitter hitting a ball deep. And
this,
you know,
could be a touchdown.
You watch a lot of baseball and you go, the hitter hit the ball deep, but that's not going out. And, you know, but the casual fans going crazy. And I'm like, he's just getting, he actually caught that ball. And it was on the replay that you go, that was awfully close.
Right.
Like, and to me, that was the second most impressive play that he had in that game, aside from that run. And it wasn't even a completion. So the other, I think, undercurrent in this that was brought up in my house, and of course, now they talk about it on ESPN, but this is the Joe Montana Super Bowl, for those who remember, which, I mean, Joe Montana with the Chiefs is a lot like Willie Mays with the Mets. Although not quite as bad.
Right.
But, you know, it was the classic sort of end of the career, going somewhere to finish it up. you know, you may see that with Brady. You may see that with Rivers. So, you know, obviously, Jerry Rice was there leading his team onto the field, running the full length of the field, looking like he could still catch a few balls.
Oh, absolutely.
Break a few tackles.
Yeah, it was fun to see him hyping up the crowd, too.
Yeah, he... I
don't know if they needed it.
No, no.
They rolled. Wow.
Yeah.
What a performance by San Fran.
So San Francisco looked great. The Packers, I don't even know if they're still in the league anymore.
I mean, they couldn't stop the run.
They couldn't do anything.
Mostert was dominant.
Yeah.
Third and eight, scoring a touchdown from, 30 yards out?
Yeah.
Let's just run a draw. Third and eight. For a touchdown.
The draw on third and long is we're done. Like, nothing is going to be made of this. We're just going to run it, set it up for a field goal if we're close enough, or set it up to punt the ball, but we're just not going to turn the ball over. He looks great. And everybody always likes to talk about Michael Jordan getting cut in high school from the varsity team as this is perseverance. That's nothing.
Not compared to
this. He's been in, seven NFL camps? This is the only time he's really stuck. And, look up his story if you haven't seen it. He's from New Smyrna Beach, Florida, a guy who loves to surf. And that was after one of the touchdowns, he did it like he was paddling into a wave.
I saw that. I hadn't seen that celebration before.
He's a surfer, of course.
Did you hear what he does before each game?
No.
He reads the list of the seven teams that cut him and the day that they cut him to use as inspiration.
Obviously, it works.
It does.
So, you know, and you can't help but root for a guy like that. What's the line? Kansas City, 1.5?
1.5.
What do you think?
I'm leaning Kansas City.
I would lean Kansas City too, but
I have until the end of the show, or actually next week.
Yeah, you do.
To make it official.
The other thing, and we're going to cut this segment in about a minute and a half, that everybody, I don't listen to sports talk radio because I hate sports talk radio, which is funny. I was listening to EEI briefly on Monday morning because I had the game on in the radio. We were driving somewhere. And, the first thing that they're talking about on EEI is how bad of a quarterback Jimmy Garoppolo is. And don't be fooled by the stats.
Oh, yeah?
I'm like, he's completed 69.8% of his passes.
He's only thrown like 10, but it's a high completion percentage.
But, like, don't be fooled by the... What else are we supposed to be fooled by?
They're not throwing it because they don't need to.
He's been fine when he's had to throw the ball. He's got, like... I don't know what his record as a starter is, but he's...
Strong to very strong?
He's like, Dwight Gooden in 85 win-loss record. Like, he's solid. And if it's not because he's throwing and all they're asking him to do is not screw the game up.
Yeah, he's doing more than that.
Fine. To say that he's not a good quarterback or to say that he's like Trent Dilfer riding somebody else's wave is completely factually inaccurate.
Yeah, I'd call him right now an above-average NFL quarterback.
Yeah, I mean he's not Joe Flacco. I mean he's not an elite quarterback.
Right,
but he's a good quarterback.
Yeah,
he's put it this way: if the Patriots had him, people would sure be happy about that.
Yeah, they would.
Yep. So I don't know, man. All right. Well, we hit a bunch of stuff. We're gonna come back and talk to the Bedford High girls hockey coach Glenn Fifield in a second. You're listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Hey, welcome back to Fox on Sports. Lauren Fox.
And Andrew Hansen.
And we are joined by Bedford High School girls hockey coach Glenn Fifield. Coach, welcome back.
Thank you, Lauren and Andrew.
Hey, it's great to have you here. We were talking off air. You had an early start this morning, practice 5 to 6 a.m. The rest of the world is sleeping, and you're prepping for a game against Concord tomorrow night.
Yes, it's going to be an exciting game as we head into the second half of our season.
It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to watch it the other night. So we are in, for those who don't know, year three of the Bedford High girls hockey program. How hard has it been for you to build a program basically from the bottom up?
We've had a really good, steadfast support from the Bedford community and the Friends of Bedford Hockey. We've had incredible support from them and even the boys' hockey team. With that kind of support, it made it easy. I mean, it's hard starting from scratch. there was some bumps and bruises on my part, nothing from the girls, my part of just knowing things and setting up, moving from a club program to a high school program. But with the support of the community, it made a smooth transition, especially into year two and three. Any hiccups were all on my part in year one.
That's a true sign of a leader there. Owns the mistakes, even when they aren't his. For you, what are some more steps that you can take to ensure that you have more of a pipeline of players who aren't sort of new skaters the first time they show up at practice?
I think we do a high school development program in the fall, or I run a program like that for girls that are interested. So if they find out about it early enough, and the girls have done a great job kind of recruiting and program from new girls that are interested from other programs. I think within the community, as people see that the girls' program's here to stay, I think those fourth, fifth, and sixth graders are really going to start going out for and joining in some of the, they don't have to join the full-fledged travel program, but some of the learn-to-play, learn-to-skate programs, some of the house rec type of programs, and really get themselves there with the interest growing in Bedford for girls' hockey.
Anything that you can do to get the word out obviously helps out, more people aware of it, of course, helps out too, and you have some good advocates in the community. Now, for you, and we're with Coach Glenn Fifield, the head coach of the Bedford High girls hockey team, you have some players who are originals who were completely green when you got them. Abby Mongefico is one who has made an impact this year. She had a hat trick in the game that we did on Monday night. How do you get new players to gain experience and overcome the sort of fear of a learning curve?
We don't call it tryouts. Like right when we meet with the girls, we call it training camp. Just kind of getting them in there and getting a mindset, letting them know that, you know, you're training and preparing for what it is. And each experienced girl knows their role within the program. And they know where they came from. They know those fears that they had to deal with. And everything like that, and everything that they had to navigate through. So with that, and within our team, they really take the girls and set up within a good community of understanding to make sure that they're welcome first and foremost. And the expectations are that we take the players at the level they're at, not the highest rated level player that they're at, with the expectation that that's what they're going to turn around to in a week.
So for you as the coach, getting players to stick with it, and I think you hit on some of these as far as the culture and the community that you create, when someone's new to skating at the game, how much is being a coach as far as technique goes, and how much is a coach as far as being a therapist?
Well, to give those girls, the new girls, confidence, we do have a coach that comes in that's really dedicated to the new girls twice a week. So when we're running practices, this coach comes in twice a week, and he works with the girls. Like when we break away into like stations and separate areas of practice, and focuses really in on their skating, giving them the confidence to step up in other drills. And then when they transition into our drills and start skating those drills, he's right there focusing on those girls that we've designated. And really work with them and giving them the confidence and breakdown and saying, okay, tweak with this, look at this, work with that. So they have a coach that's dedicated twice a week just to working with them on there. The other practice, you know, they're just in there. They're working with them, and that's what they're jumping right into the drills, and we're putting them there. But with someone within the staff is working with them to give them the confidence so they have an understanding. And we go through stuff in chalk talk time, so they have a little bit of an understanding of drills and what they are.
Coach, one thing I'm curious about, as you talk about the development and each week with the focus and practice, is if you sort of hit the pause button and look back at year one to year three, what would you say is the skill that your players have developed the most over that time period?
Definitely skating. As a program, we really, early on, we focus on that because I could have the best stick handlers in the world, but if they can't skate, they can't compete. So we really focused on skating, and a lot of the girls took it to a new level. And in this off season, they took skating lessons beyond that, what they're learning here, and really took the game personal and made that happen. So coming into the third year, we've really seen their skating abilities strengthen, so it allows us to really skate strong and compete. When we're at the Christmas tournament, we really notice, like, there's not many teams out there that skate. They work well as a team, and they can execute drills or execute plays, but as far as skating skill-wise, we can compete with the other teams. We just have to get better. I have to get better as a coach at getting them at set plays and execution of those plays.
Well, Coach, I had a chance to watch the tape of the broadcast that Lauren and Harry did on Monday, your team's win over Kingswood 7-4. And for the fans who missed it, you can go on to the YouTube page for BCTV and watch a replay of that game. And when I watched the replay, one thing that stood out to me was the girls skating. And I did notice the improvement from year one. But the other thing that jumped out to me was the passing ability. I thought a lot of your players connected on a lot of passes, put them right on the stick and, you know, hit their teammate in stride. Is that something you've seen as well?
Yeah, that's really something that we've transitioned this year with their ability, and we've gone into more gameplay and having those drills where it's not just skating drills, we're actually gameplay drills and the transition and breakouts and not attack. So they've actually, and they have more of a sense and an understanding of everything that's going on there. So it is something that we've carried. And it was refreshing to see within that game where they had time and space that they could actually execute it at a game speed.
Joined by Bedford High girls hockey coach Glenn Fifield. And Coach, we talked about it a little bit. There are some players who have had a great amount of experience at the youth hockey other levels, I guess, club teams, whether they've played for house teams, you name it. And then there are some who are brand new. How do you incorporate those two sets of players?
Baptism by fire. within practice, like I mentioned, the younger girls, they're developed with it, but each player is held accountable to their own skill set. So as we go there, they're not, our entry-level players aren't held to the highest level of club players. And we ask our club players that are there to keep their game elevated, so as to force those other girls to really develop within that. Everybody knows that type of role, so you're really pushing yourself to excel. The challenge is probably more for the club player to really, the talent, you know, what they have to execute within a drill. So they're really forced, and the coaches step up and put pressure on them to really execute at a high level. And as they're within drills and small gameplay and those type of things, it helps those other girls really force themselves to execute better within a practice and get an understanding and understand that they are judged by their own individual skill sets and not by someone else within the team. So, and that's how we break it down and communicate with them.
It was interesting the other night to see, as an example, Lauren Thomas, who I described in the broadcast as a pass first point guard. Like that is what I would think of her in basketball. Great skater, very good puck handler, but was constantly looking for her teammates and trying to involve them in the game. And that level of unselfishness it can really go a long way as far as creating that team atmosphere.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she's incredible as a freshman, her attitude that she's come in with. And as a freshman in the locker room and the way she speaks up and talks and promotes. And when she speaks about her teammates, she always finds something positive that she mentions within our talks about something that they're doing right or something that they did right on the ice. And she understands also that the strength of the team and moving forward, the more she can support her teammates and get them stronger, the better it is and the less of the burden on her shoulders.
It really showed the other night. I mean, she had, what, two goals, and she could have easily had five of them in that 7-4 win over Kingswood. So I was going to ask a little bit more about the culture and the girls having each other's backs, but I think we've touched on that now. And the other thing that I'm hearing is these pasta dinners that people host before the games.
Yeah, we do that to take a little pressure off the parents. We do it just once a week, typically for our weekend games. I know some teams do a lot, like for every game, and I'm like, we do so much going every day and night. We kind of do it on Friday nights before our weekend games, and it just really draws the girls to do well, and they get together and hang out and just become friends away from coaches and everything else, away from the structure of us.
It's a lot of fun to watch, and it's certainly fun. The girls have won their last two games. They go in, though, on Saturday night against a very tough Concord Crimson Tide team at Everett Arena up in Concord at 5:30 p.m. So good luck in that game tomorrow night, or tonight, I guess, if you're listening on Saturday.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for letting me talk to you guys. I appreciate it.
Hey, anytime. Thank you, Coach. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye.
That was Bedford High girls hockey coach Glenn Fifield. To the best of my knowledge, I don't think he's a teacher at the school. I don't know what his full-time gig is. I think for anybody who is a casual fan of any of these sports, you have no idea how much time and dedication it requires of the coaches to get out and do this. The players are out there at 5 or 6 in the morning. So is he.
That's right. He's out there for those morning practices, and he talked about doing the chalk talk sometimes
last night,
right in the evenings.
Yeah.
So it's morning and night, sort of round the clock, sort of, you know, getting in as much practice and preparation as possible.
It really does make a difference though for the girls to at least get that understanding of the game, have that time with each other. And then there's this other thing that they have that's also called school.
Right.
That is part of the equation. It's tough to find spare time and enough hours in the day to get it all done. So take a quick break. We'll come right back. You are listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox.
And Andrew Hansen.
And we just kind of went through this, like, what are we going to talk about for the next 15 minutes? But don't you worry, we have plenty of things to talk about. So if you're like everybody else in New Hampshire and Massachusetts, chances are you went skiing last Sunday, which that's one of those days that you wake up in the morning and you go, wow, we got snow and the weather is reasonably nice, and let's get in the car and go. There's only one problem, though. Everybody had the exact same idea. Were you guys at a mountain last Sunday?
Well, we were near the mountains, but we were doing a little midweek vacation, long weekend thing for Sarah's birthday.
Yep.
And I think we actually planned it out well. Where on Sunday, what we did was cross-country skiing.
Yep.
And we saved the downhill for Monday and Tuesday.
Yes.
And from what we heard, that was the wise move because the places were so crowded that they were turning people away.
Like, yes.
At Bretton Woods, apparently, the parking lot and the overflow parking lot and the backup overflow parking lot were so overflowing that they had to turn skiers away.
Bretton Woods, people were parked out on 302. So the road that runs right by, that's you don't see that. People were parked out there, which is bizarre. At Crotchet, which is my typical spot, people were parked on 136. Maggie and I got out there at probably 10:30 in the morning, and like I have a routine. I'm not going to give it away as far as what I do for parking, but long story short, it led me to the back of an upper parking lot that we usually don't wind up parking in, parked there and walked down, but we were literally the last spot in the parking lot at about 10:30, skied until about 12:30 and went, there are too many people here.
Right.
And it's more of a fact that there were just a lot of bodies out there and some people more experienced than others. Whereas you go out there on a random Tuesday at noon, there's nobody out there. You can kind of do what you want and not think about where anybody else is at any given time. But well,
that was what was so great for us to be able to do Bretton Woods on Tuesday.
Right.
Because we actually we did a full day ski on Monday, the half day at Wildcat. We did the afternoon ski, but Tuesday we did the full day. And I'm looking down, it was our first time skiing at Bretton Woods.
Yeah.
I'm looking down at the parking lot. I'm thinking, the parking lot at Pat's is bigger than this. Like, how do you fit a full load of skiers with that parking lot? So we're riding up the gondola with one of the employees of the mountain. And so he was describing to me these backup parking lots and how they were turning people away.
Yeah.
But I was just surprised looking at the size of the parking lot and thinking, man, it must have been a zoo.
Yeah. They all got it on Sunday. So Breton got it. Crotchet got it. Ragged had it where people were parked down on the roads. Pat's stopped selling tickets. Crotchet wound up stopping selling tickets. Pats and Ragged were both calling Crotchet saying, hey, we have people who want to ski. Can we send them to you? Like, it's kind of the same sort of stuff that we used to do back in the day of you'd go to golf somewhere and you'd realize, okay, the standby line's here and they're totally booked and there's nothing available. So we're going to drive half an hour to the other one and see if we can find a better setup. But it was insane. And so Sunday was, conditions were good. A few too many people. Monday conditions were very good, but it was cold.
Really cold. I got to tell you a story about Monday in the cold.
Yes.
So we're at Wildcat, and it was so windy going down a pretty steep slope that it was almost like you weren't making any progress skiing down the hill, because it was like a 40-mile-an-hour gust in your face, and it was, you know, below 10 degrees. So it was really chilly, and we'd done about 3 runs in the afternoon. And somehow on the third run down, we ended up on a course where there were high school skiers training with the gates up. So about halfway down, I was like, oh, I'm going to see what this is like. So I go through the gates at the bottom, you know, feel like I'm an Olympic skier.
Yeah.
And I get through that stretch and I'm thinking, wow, I'm pretty proud of myself. I got through that stretch. Let me head down towards the lodge here and we'll figure out how many more runs we're going to do. And as I, right after I got off that stretch, I entered this area where they were making snow. And it was flying up, you know, they were shooting it up in the air. It was coming down like if you're running through the yard and you'd had a sprinkler in the summer.
Yeah.
So I thought, oh, this will be fun. I'll just go through this. And as I'm going through.
It's not fun.
It's not, because I kind of look up and I'm like, wow, this is funny to go through all this snow that's flying through the air. And then before you know it, I felt like I was a foot under the snow and I fell forward. And then in about 10 seconds, I had a layer of ice all over me.
Yep.
Because the snow that's being made in 10 degrees is turning into ice on my face mask. And it was just a mess.
Yeah. Here's the thing. And for anybody who doesn't ski or doesn't know, snow is basically like white gold. Like it is for the ski areas. If you don't have it, you can't sell tickets, plain and simple. And so when the weather gets cold, that's where they take their opportunity to make snow, because even if it's man-made, you can groom it. Give somebody some good corduroy, some nice groomers to ski on, which is more comfortable for somebody who is beginner to intermediate. The real challenge, though, is you have to also be mindful of the experience of people who are out there on the mountain at any given time. They were probably making snow on Tuesday because it was a Tuesday and nobody was there. The Monday before, I had been out at Bretton Woods, and they were making snow because nobody was out there. And honestly, because they had to, because for the mountains, Martin Luther King weekend is one of the biggest weekends of the year. It's smack dab right in the middle of January. Usually it's a great weekend as far as conditions go. You haven't had that kind of weird early season warm-up that we've gotten. But in this case, we had the early season warm-up a week and a half before. And so now the mountains are like, all right, we got to make as much snow as we can. And then they got a gift from the skiing gods that a half a foot of snow comes down, and it was good, solid, light, pretty, I mean, for here, very, very good snow, fun snow.
Yeah, we got lucky with the timing of our trip. But it was a learning experience for me, really, going through that snow, because, you know, right after I got myself organized and up, somebody else helped pick up my poles and all that, but two people fell right behind me, too.
It's a slightly different texture, and it's grabby.
Right, very grabby.
Yeah, and that's why. I mean, you have that sort of, you throw the brakes on and you lurch forward. That's why. My current skiing experience, so I'm doing the Race League at McIntyre on Tuesdays, which is a blast. Like, I wish I had done this for years. But I think my performance is good for somebody who has never ski raced before. But so you do runs at McIntyre, and the guy who wins it is like 17-ish,
17 you know, seconds.
Seconds, yeah. My times, and it's bizarre.
Are there any gates up, or is it just straight down?
Yeah, there are gates. It's giant slalom. So the first time out, I was within about a half second on two runs. And run one, I was like, well, this is what I could have done better and what I could have learned. And I watched a couple people. All right, so this is what I need to do differently. So I picked up about a half a second. Then Tuesday I go out and I was within a tenth of myself
Better or worse?
Like, it's a slightly different course, but...
Both runs that day?
21.3, 21.4. Okay. It was like right there. So then I'm sitting and I'm feeling like I skied a good race technically, but I can't figure out, like, how am I losing 3 or 4 seconds? So I went to YouTube. I did what any self-respecting person would do, and I went to YouTube to try to figure it out because I don't know what a race start is supposed to be like. And sure enough, you go and you watch what the race start is supposed to be like. All right, that would really explain a lot because the way I'm pushing myself, my legs go through first and I don't have a whole lot of momentum. There are better ways to start where you're, for all intents and purposes, popping out of the closet like a magic show down. And by the time you go through the wand, you're at like a 40 degree angle going down. Like that makes a job. Like,
so you get to start moving before the timer starts?
Absolutely.
And how much distance do you get?
The timer doesn't go until your wand goes. So you could sit there all day and be like, yep, you know, I'm waiting for the wind to come to my back. But no, so like you have the ability to sort of push yourself up and launch yourself down in order to do that. Like
launching sounds good. That sounds like a fun, good way to save time.
Yeah. So, but I mean, for me I ski a lot, which is really no secret to anybody that knows me, but if we're talking about a longer run, yeah, if you take the start out of the equation, there's a good chance I can beat you. If I don't know how to start, forget it. Well, I have no chance.
It sounds like that new technique will gain you a second or two, perhaps.
Well, here's the thing, though. I have no way to practice it. Like, I can sit there on a tile floor, and then I'm out running this morning, and I'm like, maybe I could build myself like a little start gate in the backyard. How dumb would that be? I mean, it's possible.
I think you start. I think
I
you
have
need
plywood
to use,
and wood.
I think you need to use visualization.
I have been actually. Okay, good. Yes. Yeah. No, it's true. But yeah, I'm sitting here like this is ridiculous. This is what I am now perseverating on. Why can't I ski faster? Even though I think I'm skiing plenty fast, it's just a really garbage start. So I don't know. There's still people that are going to beat me. Don't get me wrong. There are a lot of people who are really fast out there, but I should do better. So, all right. So tonight, which is Friday night, you're listening on Saturday probably or Sunday, but tonight you and I are going to do some girls basketball at the high school. They host Londonderry. Got an email from Coach Kevin Gibbs, a day or two ago, where he described his team as a MASH unit. But you still have some of the big names out there and healthy. Amanda Jonas, healthy, looking good. She has signed with Rhode Island College. So congratulations to Amanda for now taking the next step in her basketball career. But really the key to tonight's game or yesterday's game, if you're listening on Saturday, is can you keep the players that you're going to need in the game? Keep them out of foul trouble.
Yeah, there's only so much you can do in terms of depth when you're working with a roster of 11 players, and we know that Olivia King has been swinging up to kind of fill the void with the injuries, but it sounds like it's sort of hit the entire roster up and down the lineup, the various injuries and ailments.
It's kind of like a flu bug, except it's, yeah.
A variety of injuries.
It's like in the movie The Natural, losing is a disease. But yeah, so that's what Coach Gibbs is dealing with. We had that game where Bedford's boys team lost last second to Wynnum. They then went to Keene, and the Blackbirds flew throughout the gym. I was trying to come up with something, and I really had nothing, and that's all I got. Keene won by 20 in that one, and then they came back. Who was their win? Oh, Memorial.
Bedford boys beat Memorial by 5 at home.
So, and then tonight, Friday night, the Bulldogs will travel to Londonderry.
Correct.
To take on the Lancers at 6:30 p.m. as well. They're always a tough opponent, particularly at home, too. So good luck to the boys in that one. Yeah, our winter sports are in full swing. I'm going to say it again. I miss the Runaway Bulldog and the sports updates that we would get frequently. So we may have to just start emailing some of the coaches and just saying, hey, bring it. We need help.
Right. We'll take the updates with some insight and inside information.
Right. I mean, anything that you can give us, we can share. So I guess while I'm thinking of it as well, the Bedford Little League now has registration open on its website. So if you have not registered your child, basically what, the age of four? How old was Darius when he played last year?
He was 3.5.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
So, but I mean, his dad played pro ball, so like you can get away with that. If you have a youngster that's interested in playing, sign him up. Great coaching, great opportunities, but don't wait for too long because there are some winter workout opportunities that you won't want to miss for your ball players. What else is going on around town? Or what? I mean, I feel like we've kind of hit everything. Like, you know, it has been a sort of strange sports week where we're in this lull. The only bright side I can see, by the way, because talking about the Astros and the Red Sox and the Mets, the real bright side that I can see out of that whole thing was that for one brief moment in January, everybody was talking about baseball.
That's right. Usually you don't get that in the offseason. We did also get the Hall of Fame announcements.
Yes, worth talking about.
Yeah.
So Larry Walker, 10th year on the ballot,
yes,
gets in.
Just in time.
Yep.
Snuck in there.
Former Expo.
I was glad to hear about that.
Yeah, he was, I mean, you'll never forget Larry Walker going up to the plate in the All-Star game with his helmet on backwards to face Randy Johnson.
Can't blame him.
No, I can't blame him either. So, but that was back before the days of interleague play when that was a novelty to have one guy facing the other guy. You know, he was always a guy who was great for the game. And then the other one, have they figured out yet, by the way, who the one guy who decided that Derek Jeter shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame was?
The last I heard, he had not decided whether he wanted to remain anonymous.
If you're gonna be that guy, you have to just, hey, I didn't vote for Jeter and here's why. But that's silly.
Like, that is. It's a little bit silly.
Well, I mean, at what point? Okay.
It's just a holdover from the tradition of we're just not going to vote people in on the first ballot.
But if they're good enough to make it on the first, elect them.
And it's not like
and it's not like 25% of the electorate is going to say, we agree with you. He shouldn't be in on the first ballot. He was a first ballot Hall of Famer. He should have been a first ballot Hall of Famer. And if you're going to be dumb enough to say, Jeter's not in my top 10, then you deserve to be named.
And it's not like he had 11 other guys he wanted to vote for this year.
Right.
Those are the only two that got in.
Right.
So he has no excuse.
I'm not voting for Jeter, but I will use my vote for Roger Clemens.
Yeah, right. But I want to hit on the stats real quick for Larry Walker because there is that narrative that goes along with him of, well, he played in Coors Field.
Yep.
But how about this? His OPS career on the road, 1.176. At home, 1.169. So he had a better OPS on the road than he did at home. And some of these numbers are just beautiful. His batting titles, when he hit 366, 363, and 379, wow.
Yep.
I'm glad he got in.
Yeah, I am too. I'm willing to bet that the guy who did not vote for Derek Jeter is the same guy who voted for J.J. Putz.
Oh, gosh.
J.J. Putz got a vote. So did Brad Penny.
Yikes.
Adam Dunn got a vote. Josh Beckett did not get a vote.
I'm fine with that.
I would say that Beckett would get a vote for me before J.J. Putz or Brad Penny.
True.
I still have, I don't have it anymore. When I was working in San Bernardino, the Dodgers used to send out a CD of all their players with pictures that you could use for the scoreboard, major league all the way down to minors, so that you had somebody asked if they had a nice scoreboard, hey, can you send pictures over? Sure, great. Or you'd put it up when a guy came to bat. For Brad Penny, one of his pictures, he was showing the middle finger. Nice. All right. Thank you to our guest, Glenn Fifield, for taking the time to join us. Thank you to the crew here at Bedford 105.1, Harry, Bill, Colleen, and George for everything they do. Thanks to my broadcast partner, Andrew Hansen. Have a lovely sports week. Go and cheer on a Bedford team. I don't even care what age. Youth all the way up to high school. Go and just cheer. Like, make them know that you care about what they're doing, how they're playing. Be encouraging. You are listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.